Marshall and Sagar here. Welcome back to The Realignment.
This week, we are very excited to say we have 790 ratings. That's right, everybody. We are almost 200 away from the 1,000 five-star ratings. Why does that matter? Because that's when we're going to stop bothering you. So you can scroll down to the bottom of that Apple Podcasts app, rate us 5 stars. It dramatically helps other people find the show. We would just appreciate it so, so much. And don't forget, which is that if you leave us a 5-star rating and you write a rating, you know, in that little written box, you can leave us a question, which we will answer right here on the air. So, Marshall, what do we have as our question this week?
Yeah, quick thing before I hit that. It's very funny. I was actually talking to a prominent DC figure, and the prominent DC figure has a message for you guys. Please get your ratings in. He has rated us, and he is sick and tired of hearing us, quote, beg for the ratings. So do this person a favor. Do us a favor. Get us the 210 ratings we need. So share the podcast with your friends. Share it with your family. There's plenty of good stuff to go around. So on to this week's question. A reminder, email us at realignmentpod@gmail.com to send in your question the way today's question did. So quick note, this week we did our question a little differently. Mike actually sent us this question. And this question was actually so valid that we decided to ask this question to today's guest. So I'm going to read this question for you guys. So just keep it in the back of your mind. Sagar and I both give our answers to this during the episode. So who do you guys think the fundraising base for the average House member, say from Peoria or Toledo, who's running on an Orrin Cass-style populist platform, who would they be? Is it small donors from the lower middle class? I just can't see it being Wall Street types or the upper middle class donors with more socially liberal views. So we get into this question later into the episode. Sagar, who are we actually speaking about this question with?
Well, we have rising favorite Rachel Bovard. Rachel actually joined the podcast in one of its earliest days. She really is a jack of all trades on the conservative movement. She works at the Conservative Partnership Institute, where she works on all things legislative. But the thing that I find most interesting about Rachel is that she's somebody who came up in libertarian politics and is now somebody on the right who wants to talk very seriously about corporate power, about the way that corporate power can pose a threat to your life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, and how we might think about that in the same context about original conservative skepticism of big government. So she's here to talk about the Supreme Court. She's here to talk about tech and so much more. What do you say, Marshall?
Yeah, so I really suggest you guys go back to, I think it was our 9th episode of Rachel, because that episode was all about how conservatives are approaching the big tech issue. Now, today's episode is much more focused, like Sagar said, just on the court, and we go through the TikTok debate, how we should handle Huawei and WeChat. So there's really a lot there, but this conversation was just very helpful because Rachel does a great job of doing, I think this comes from the fact that she worked on The Hill, is articulating different points of views, understanding these sort of coalitions, and she really sort of focuses well on the theme that Sagar and I are really pumped to explore moving forward, which is what is power? How does power manifest itself? And how do institutions choose to or choose not to actually articulate power themselves? So a lot of great stuff here. We'll dive into the episode. But last but not least, a huge thank you to Lincoln Network, the host and sponsor of this podcast. We are getting closer and closer and closer to the Reboot 2020 conference. There's a lot of really great speakers. Tyler Cowen is going to speak. Trey Stevens of Anduril, which is a defense tech company, is going to speak. There's going to be a lot of really great stuff going on, and Sagar and Rachel will be there as well. So be sure to go to rebootconference.org to sign up. Let's dive into the episode. Rachel, welcome back to The Realignment. You were one of our first early show guests, pre-Rogan, pre-Crystal Bump. So we're glad to have you back with an actual audience this time.
I'm so pumped to be here. Thanks
for having me. She's back, everybody. Rachel is back. Very excited to see her. Rachel, Supreme Court stuff obviously is all happening. I couldn't think of anybody else that I wanted to join and just break it down for everybody. I think there's so much going on here. you've kind of been embedded within this fight for a while and you've been around Washington. Just tell us, what does the RBG vacancy actually mean to the right? And try to be fair to everybody here, right? Like the Kochs, the social cons, people like us, like whatever. And you can place yourself, you know, feel free to put yourself wherever you are. But just explain it to the audience, because I think this is one of the most opaque areas in which some of our more left-wing audience just wouldn't really understand what exactly is going on here right now.
Yeah, well, it's a massive significance, this seat. You can actually overstate what a big deal this is for the Republican Party, I think. But I think it has to be put in this broader context, I think, a little bit to your point, which is, you know, for both parties, I think the furor over the Supreme Court really reflects the fact that we are almost in this post-constitutional place where Congress doesn't legislate anymore. Mm-hmm. And so the courts have become sort of the final arbiter of every major decision that we make as a country. And I'm not just talking about, you know, how we treat, you know, business law. I'm talking about major questions about the social order. Not just, you know, we're talking about immigration, abortion, healthcare, you know, you name it. All of this should be, in my view, decided by the popularly elected branch that, you know, you can vote out if you disagree with them, but right. They don't want that accountability. So they've transmitted it to the courts. And this is why I think you're seeing such a high stakes response to the seat, you know, from both the left and the right, because both of them recognize that this has the power to set the agenda for the country, you know, for the foreseeable future, because again, Congress does nothing. So, you know, everything is translated to the courts.
So you worked on the Hill. So can you actually speak about this idea of Congress giving up power? Because I think that doesn't really make sense, right? From a political philosophy perspective, like why would, you know, you're an ambitious person, you run for office, why would you give up power over basically every question in our society, the way you sort of framed it? So what's the background there?
Well, they don't talk like they give up power, right? Every fundraising email that you're going to get is going to talk about how powerful these guys are. So they know they have this power. But again, you know, they don't want to use it. And I think it's an electoral issue, right? There's an accountability that comes with a voting record. And that's why I think you see this particularly in the Senate. The Senate, these guys spend millions of dollars to get to the Senate. And the thing they hate the most when they're there is being senators and voting. Like yes. The Senate doesn't take any votes on anything. And it's a very specific choice. And you saw this, I think, really start under Harry Reid, but Mitch McConnell has continued it, which is to protect his incumbent senators from taking any political vote on any question. He wants to keep their powder dry so they never have to face ramifications for it when they get reelected, or if they do. And so I think that's the general shift. Is it's all about accountability, right? Like you can scream and gnash your teeth about what Obama did or what Trump did, but the answer to that is actually passing laws. Like that is the answer. But you never hear it. You never hear it from the left who's burned down the place about Trump's actions on immigration. They could change immigration law. You know, they could do the hard work of legislating, and same with the right. They could actually change abortion law instead of, you know, forcing it to the courts, but they never do.
I'm so glad that you said that, Rachel. I've been trying to say it kind of all week, which is that they just put us in this situation, and you're very right to point to, it's left and right, where they want us to think that the only way to do this is through the courts. And if that's true, then we have to vote for them. Whatever they do in Congress or not do, we're like, well, you know, if I still want this to happen, then I have to vote for this guy so he'll approve the right justice. Now, take us a little bit through the framework of how the right traditionally has approached judges. So there's this thing called the Federalist Society, which we've talked a little bit about on the podcast in the past, where they are kind of, I wouldn't say control the process, although that's probably more fair than it's not, but they have quite a bit of input, and they are a network kind of a judicial communities and law schools and of professionals that kind of control the pipeline of judgeships, which then create the pipeline to how you become a Supreme Court justice in the first place. Talk about the evolution of that movement and its impact on right politics today.
Yeah, the Federalist Society, you know, it's almost to talk about their impact, it's almost useful to think about how judges were selected before the Federalist Society. I think you kind of can see the significant difference, because before FedSoc existed on the right, there was very much a culture in the Senate that the senior senator was allowed to pick whoever that judge was, or the Supreme Court justice was sort of chosen by like the Senate's leadership. And they in turn were informed by their sort of statewide parochial legal interests. So, mm-hmm. you know, it wasn't sort of this, you know, ideological process. It was very much parochial. And so FedSoc, you know, I think organized itself initially, and it still is this, you know, to a great extent, a law school campus organization to sort of, you know, provide a place for conservatives to grow conservative legal tradition. And I think that's actually a very valuable role that it plays and continues to play. Where I think it's grown in sort of questionable significance is that it now acts as sort of like an ordainment of, you know, mm-hmm. judges on the right, that the Republican Party in the Senate cannot choose a judge that has not been given the imprimatur of the Federalist Society and everything that that means. And so that's, I think, where it sort of has risen in, you know, lore, right, is that yeah. it's this like shadowy organization that controls a lot of these judges. But it has a lot of significance now because of the choice the Senate made to focus exclusively, like Mitch McConnell has focused the Senate exclusively on judicial confirmations in you know the last 4 years. And so the Federalist Society has played this huge role. I mean, remember Leonard Leo, who was the head of the Federalist Society, took a leave of absence and went and advised the Trump administration, you know, on their Supreme Court picks and on their judicial picks more generally. And so, mm-hmm. you know, I don't think that they loom as large as the left likes to make them out. They like to make them out as this like shadowy cabal. They're pretty transparent about what they do, but they do have a very, very heavy influence. And I think there's some on the right who say, you know, should we have more voices at the table?
Yeah. So something that's always interested me is the sort of differing ways that the left and right have approached the nature of court justices. So I remember back during the Bernie, Biden, Pete, Kamala battle, so many people on the left, and we're really speaking to sort of like left Bernie types, would mock center-left Democrats who would talk about how the courts are sort of everything, and at a certain point there is a sort of existential nature. And that's obviously something that, coming from the right, I think Sagar and I are both sympathetic to that. No, actually, like, the courts are a huge deal. And if you're on, like, if you're a pro-choice voter, actually, like, you probably should vote like on the courts. That's actually not a crazy idea. So why do you think there's a different approach to these issues from the left and the right's perspective?
Well, I think you're right. I think the left emphasized the courts, I think, to a great degree first, right? They said, like, we have to care about these issues, you know, and how these laws are going to be interpreted. We can have a longer term impact, right? Because when you appointed someone to the courts, they're there for life. Particularly at the, you know, at the federal level. And so I think they recognized that before the right even got on that train, I think. You know, and I hesitate to say there is even a difference at this point. You know, I think both parties have realized that, you know, this is where the game is now being played, and maybe they have different incentives for doing so, but I think largely the legislators on either side just don't want the accountability of having to make these decisions themselves. I think we try to make it a little bit more complicated than it is, mm-hmm. but it's really just about that. It's really about electoral sinecure and like never having to make a significant choice, policy choice, one way or the other. That's how I would put it.
Well, quick, I love that you keep bringing back. Oh yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, can we keep referencing the choices that Congress could make, like, without like necessarily you recommending a choice, like, what are these choices, right? Because if you sort of think, once again, you've got a bunch of voters on the right who've been told, insert Roe v. Wade's the law of the land, until we appoint justices, we can't do anything. What would things on a federal level sort of look like? Because the reason why the court matters so much is it has the ability to sort of overturn state laws, which Congress in many ways sort of doesn't have. So can you just fill out the perspective of what choice looks like in this sense?
Yeah. And I think to your point, like, the courts have a role. Like, I'm not trying to undermine the important role they play. They do. But again, we have three branches of government, not two. And we're living in a scenario almost where we just have two. But I think what it would look like, you know, on any of these federal questions, think about just the Affordable Care Act, right? Like, Congress actually took steps toward that, right? Republicans took steps toward trying to, you know, either reform or overturn the Affordable Care Act. They then stopped and they just outsourced it completely to the courts and said, we're going to let the courts try and gut this, mm-hmm. right? And that's when, you know, John Roberts made his infamous, like, you know, the individual mandate is not a tax, you know, that kind of whole thing.
Yes.
But had they actually taken the mandate that they had to change the law, we would be living in a much different environment right now. I don't know what, it, you know, how the Republican vision of healthcare reform. But again, on abortion as well, like, the last big legislative push the Republicans made on abortion was the partial birth abortion ban. That was it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that was decades ago at this point. And on every other question, whether it's conscience protections, whether it's fetal tissue research, where, you know, all these, you know, it's not just about the right to abortion, it's all these other questions, you know, they could have acted on this. And I think that's what infuriated so many of the religious conservatives about the Bostock decision, which was decided by Neil Gorsuch, is that Congress had been wrestling with that question for so long and nobody wanted to deal with it.
Let's explain what Bostock is.
Yeah, so the Bostock decision was Bostock v. Clayton County, authored by Neil Gorsuch, essentially just added gender identity and, you know, kind of this definition of sex to the Civil Rights Act, an employment discrimination law. And it opened up, and people like to say, well, it's just about, you know, allowing you to be a bigot. Well, that's not how the right views it. The right views it as a very fundamental question of religious liberty. Do people of faith, of any faith, you know, not just Protestant, Catholic, of any faith, have the right to run their businesses the way they want to run them? And so the downstream effects of this, I think, are going to be very significant on religious liberty in this country. But Congress had been, again, wrestling with this question for a long time and just stopped. And I think the reaction from Republican legislators to Bostock was very telling, because instead of being outraged, they were transparently relieved that they didn't have to answer this question. And they were very happy that Neil Gorsuch, the textualist that he apparently is, read what effectively is a new law into an old one. Mm-hmm. And he usurped the congressional imperative to make law, and they were happy about it.
Yeah, I think that is absolutely telling. And I'm really glad that you keep bringing it back to this, because it is something where, as you point out, Congress actually was grappling with this issue and just was like, actually, let's just let the little courts handle it. And I mean, it is kind of insane to think that on a 5-4 decision that you're going to decide something of such importance. And look, I want everybody to take off their social kind of blinders and think about what actually happened here, because there's a very good chance the Democrats could have got some of these Republicans to actually sign on to what the eventual outcome was. They just didn't want to, right? Like, nobody actually wants to face any potential blowback whenever something like this happens. But in the realm of court politics, let's take ourselves outside of the Congress sucks and they've abdicated all the responsibility.
These are our greatest hits. We're gonna do something hard for a second. Yeah.
Let's take ourselves out of that, as much as I love to live. Within the realm of the courts decide everything, what has that action been like under the Trump administration? Because people who are culturally conservative were promised in Trump 2016, they were like, look, the guy is uncouth, but he's going to appoint these judges which agree with you. Now, as you point out, the Bostock decision was actually authored by Neil Gorsuch, the very first person Donald Trump put on the court. And Judge Kavanaugh apparently Judge Roberts has also ruled, you know, not necessarily with culturally conservative Republicans in some cases. How did that happen? Because I think it's very interesting that right justices are questionable on where they're going to fall. I mean, nobody has any idea. Like, nobody has a question on where Sotomayor or Kagan is going to come down in terms of a social issue. On a corporate issue, that's another matter. But let's stick within the realm of social right now.
Yeah. No, it's a huge open question, I think, for the right, that, you know, these people that we were promised, the right was promised, you know, that we'd get everything we ever wanted if we just got the, you know, one more justice on the court.
Yeah, one more seat. Know. That's what they say every time, right?
Right. Roe would fall and, like, whatever, you know, and it never happens. And I think, you know, the Gorsuch decision was the final nail in the coffin for a lot of, you know, social conservatives, religious conservatives who have been questioning why this hasn't been happening. And I think it should have forced more self-reflection on the conservative legal movement than it has. You know, we should be waking up and saying something isn't going right in our process, you know, if this is what's happening. And I think, you know, to your point about how we never question where Kagan and Sotomayor and all these, like, left-leaning justices are, part of it is how the left-leaning senators in Congress approach their nominees, right? They make them sign effectively like blood oaths, you know, to get the nod. They have no qualms about asking very specific questions about, you know, jurisprudence, future jurisprudence, past judicial opinions. And the right has for a long time currently stays away from that. We're told, well, we don't want activist judges. We want independent thinkers. Mm-hmm. But I think that calculus changes. If you are going to make these judges decide these really important cultural questions and Congress is not going to take responsibility for them, then you're effectively pushing the role of the politician onto the courts without treating them with the rigor that, you know, a politician and scrutiny that a politician deserves. So if we are going to make judges our politicians, I think there's an argument that we got to start treating them that way from the outset.
You just spoke to a really, really, really important dynamic and debate that has people on both sides of it, which is how should the right reimagine its conception of how government should work in sort of the current era. So for example, there are a lot of people on the right who for a long time have had a project of thinking, hey, like the Department of Education is unconstitutional. It's this bad thing. Like we should get rid of it. It's just big government, that sort of thing. But at the same time, we saw the incident last week where Betsy DeVos or people at the Department of Education were able to sort of push back against Princeton using that federal power. So when we look at an America that in many ways is not only hostile to, but simply not sort of staffed by or has any sort of social conservatism present in it, how should the right think about those institutions? Because I think what I got an argument from a libertarian friend of mine, which is basically like, look, if you're a social conservative, like the Department of Ed probably is the only way you could push back against a lot of sort of things that are existing right now. So how should they balance? And this goes to your point about thinking about judges in a new way. So the big question I'm asking you then really is, how should the right reimagine the way they approach these things in this context?
Yeah, this is the crux of how the Republican Party, I think, responds to the Trump era, because, you know, this is exactly the internal, very somewhat violent debate that is happening now among Republicans.
Lots of Twitter fights, lots of high stakes.
It's harsh out there, folks. It's very harsh out there.
You guys don't even know. I'm just kidding. But you know, it is, because this is it's been intellectual dogma, you know, in the Republican Party for a very long time, that, you know, the best way to do this is the free market, just, you know, create an alternative, you know, university, burn down the Department of Education, like, you know, and I think in theory, I don't necessarily disagree, but in practice, we've seen that it hasn't worked out. Yeah. Right. And I think you see a lot of conservatives like myself who feel like the institutions are an existential threat now to the way of life of Republicans and, well, more conservatives, I think I would say. And so it is actually appropriate in the short term to respond, you know, with the force necessary to make sure that you still have an area to survive. It's not like I'm simply using, you know, weapons of federal power because I, you know, woke up one day and feel like it. Their conservatives feel like they are in a fight for their survival. And long term, we may not support, you know, institutionalizing, you know, this federal power. But in the short term, what choice do we have? You know, I see this a lot on the big tech fight. There's people who say, well, the best way to solve this is to address the woke culture at universities. And I don't disagree with that long-term solution. But in the short term, we have to, you know, carve out an area for us to be able to implement that long-term solution, or else we're not even going to be here. I think you have people who recognize the stakes in that way, and you have people that just refuse to.
So a quick moment of audience advocacy, because I think half our audience, when you said conservatives are under threat, like tore out their AirPods and threw them on the ground, right? So could you just sort of like articulate for, and I mean, this is August point about good, can you just articulate for them why you sort of feel that way? And why, not just you, but why conservative and genuinely feel this way?
No, and I think it's like, to be fair, like I have a lot of liberal friends as well, and they also feel it passionately, right? Like they feel passionately that they are existentially threatened. And I think that passion on both sides is contributing to, I think, the tenor of the debate that we see now. But I think for conservatives, it's about their way of life. I think for social conservatives in particular, they feel threatened at every corner by woke capital, right? All these corporations that they do business with hate them. You know, they see them, you know, rage against any kind of traditional way of life. You know, Amazon doesn't let Amazon Smile doesn't let you make donations to the Family Research Council. You know, they see little elements like this. You know, Bank of America won't do business with law enforcement at the border. You know, furniture companies like won't build beds for ICE. You know, everybody's hating on cops, you know. It's like little elements like this in the culture that are outside of politics. It's just how you interact with society is now changing. And, you know, they use Facebook, and Facebook, you know, you want to put up a fundraiser for Kyle Rittenhouse because you think he, you know, shot in self-defense, that will be taken down. You know, just every area they have to interact with society is now changing. You know, and I think it's been, this has been happening over time, but I think it's been put on blast a little bit, you know, particularly even now in the COVID-19 restrictions where, you know, in DC, I can't go to mass without registering, right? And if my mass fills up, I can't go at all. But if I wanted to go down for a 50,000 person protest on the mall, the city is fine with that. And so even it's even little things like that, that I think just resonate in ways they haven't before.
It's fascinating too, because I completely agree with you and I feel it every way, but it's just those types of grievances are just not ones that people on the left will appreciate. And they would be like, well, the right has power of government, right? Like, you guys are coming after Roe versus Wade. You're about to have 6-3 court seats on the court. I mean, you have prevented us from enacting our agenda. And somehow it's like you have both people feeling this like deep sense of grievance as if a core value has been robbed. It does absolutely fascinate me. And I guess, I mean, this is a much broader philosophical question, but to like kind of bring it back to the courts, I have like a real thesis here that yes, part of this is like the culture war and it's here to stay, but that one of the ways in order to address this is to talk about power in our society, which is held by a very set group of economic elites. And this is where I have seen a lot of pushback from some of my more socially conservative friends in recent days when we start asking questions about Amy Coney Barrett. She's currently the person who is the front runner to replace RBG on the Supreme Court. She is something called an originalist. And look, for all our lawyers out there, I will be botching this. But as I understand it, that is somebody who could strike down many measures which could be used to rein in big business. And that concerns me. And the thing that I'm basically told, Rachel, is shut up. Roe versus Wade is what we should really care about here. Is there a way to try and think about those two things together as somebody who is a culturally conservative person yourself, but also cares about corporate power?
Yeah, like the courts... My theory on this is that courts are never going to save us from corporate power. Like, mm-hmm. I don't think our laws are set up that way. And that's why I get so frustrated with Congress, because they refuse to address anything. And I think, you know, you have these statutes that were passed by Congress that have become so judicially contorted, right, to incentivize all kinds of behavior, protect all kinds of corporate behavior that I just don't think they should. But of course, the courts are going to rely on their own precedent. Like, I think it's pie in the sky to expect them not to, right? Mm-hmm. And that's why Congress has to do something about it. Like, they actually have to change the law. And I think also, you know, you have a lot of these judges who are raised, you know, in an administrative law environment. Like, they are raised to protect corporations. So it's a cultural phenomenon that I don't think you're going to purge from the courts, you know, with one Supreme Court justice. But again, this is something that I think is shifting or needs to shift on the right. And I think you're seeing it a little bit, this deference toward corporations and corporate power is changing slowly, but somewhat significantly.
Yeah.
Something that would be important to note, because it sort of ran throughout this conversation, is what, and I don't mean to sound obtuse, but what do social conservatives want in terms of the America they want to sort of live in? Because this is something where people... in many ways, in the left are sort of stuck in the year 2004, when in many ways you could argue social conservatism was on the offense, right? So George W. Bush is running for re-election on, you know, a constitutional amendment defining marriage between one man and one woman. There's obviously a situation where Prop 8 was passing in California. So California, of all places, was passing a law that, you know, banned gay marriage. You know, Gavin Newsom was edgy for allowing gay marriage in San Francisco when he was mayor there. Man, we really sort of do have a consistent set of characters in these stories, so it's easy to remember. But now that that has all changed, and we do have the situation where social conservatism feels under threat, what is the actual ask? What is the ask that you think the community wants?
Yeah, really good question. Obviously, we want The Handmaid's Tale in real life. I don't know if you've seen any of
it. Reuters said that. Reuters, they were just asking questions, to be fair.
Yeah, we want the patriarchy, obviously. No, I think it's a good question, because it's changed over time, right? To your point, like, society has changed on these questions. So I don't, you know, the sort of ban on gay marriage is not a priority for most social conservatives anymore. I think they recognize, you know, society itself has moved beyond that. I think centrally, what most social conservatives want now is the ability to just live unmolested, like live their faith and live their belief without being sued for it. They want to live in a world where a group of nuns, the Little Sisters of the Poor, doesn't have to go to court to fight a mandate that they have to buy birth control, because that is against their religious beliefs. Like, they don't want that to happen. They don't, you know, we want a situation where the adoption agency, the religious adoption agency that facilitated the adoption of two of my aunts from Korea, can still exist, even if they don't want to place babies, you know, with a homosexual couple. Like, mm-hmm. they want that kind of ability and liberty that they used to just be commonplace. Right. And they feel is further under assault. And just actually recently, the first case was filed using Bostock as a precedent against a Catholic hospital, because the Catholic hospital wanted to be able to ask about biological gender when they're treating a patient. And under Bostock, it says, no, you're not allowed to ask that. You have to, you know, go with people as they identify. Most social conservatives say, no, that religious hospital that doesn't take federal funding should be allowed to do that.
Well, quick question about that, right? Because, and this is where the translation error happens. Like, why is the gender question being asked, right? Because what I would anticipate a liberal would say is they're asking that question because there's a world where they wouldn't offer care. I'm just sort of curious about how that's what's contextually happening there.
Yeah.
Like, is there a world where a hospital says, you are, you know, a trans man, we don't want to treat you because of our religious beliefs? Like, that's the narrative I think a left person would say.
Well, I think that's currently illegal, so I don't think that they could actually.
So that's not up for debate.
No, it's, at this point, it's just about, you know, this particular Catholic hospital just wanted to know what they were dealing. I mean, for treatment purposes, they're like, what are we biologically? Who am I treating? Yes. Right, that's kind of what they want to know, not gender as a construct, but gender as a biological reality to inform treatment. And you know, it's the same with the girls' sports debate, right? Like, a lot of social conservatives are like, my daughter, they don't want their daughters to have to compete against biological men in women's sports. And you can't talk about that, right? Like, you're not even allowed to have that debate. Like, American Principles Project tried to run an ad about that on Facebook, and Facebook censored it. They took it down because PolitiFact was like, this is missing context, whatever that means, right? So they want to, so most social conservatives just want to be able to talk about these things and have their organizations, you know, be able to practice their faith in a way that is allows for the pluralism, you know, that our society rests on. I think that's, to take it back to sort of a philosophical side, you know, are we a nation where many beliefs can flourish, or are we not?
I'm glad you're laying this out, because people on the left literally just do not understand that a lot of this is happening. And to the extent that they do, they don't really see a problem with it. And I think that it needs to be explained in the context of a pluralistic society argument, which is that, look, we're not all going to agree with each other, but there needs to be space in order to actually enact, you know, things that you agree with. And, you know, we do live in like a religious country, or a lot of people here are religious, and there's nothing wrong with that. I want to push a little bit on the core question, though, which is that the response that I get from people who care so much about these things is, that's why you have to go all in on the Supreme Court. I fundamentally do not believe, I think I'm just so cynical, I do not think that conservative courts are going to deliver on any of this. I think only a legislature or a executive branch would be able to do that. Why is it, again, though, that people are pushing everything to the court? I mean, is there any realistic possibility that what you just laid about Facebook, I mean, that's going to get solved through Congress? Let's be honest. Like, that's right. Not a court decision. And yet, over and over again, we're just told, nope, that's why we have to have another social conservative on the Supreme Court.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's a cynical way to say all your problems will be solved in this one fell swoop. How easy, you know,
yes,
it's
right.
Like,
yeah.
You know, yeah. That should raise suspicion, right? When it's that easy that all, you know, every major social issue is going to be solved instantly with the right Supreme Court justice. Like, don't ever believe that on either side. But, you know, but I think to your point, like, history bears this out as well. Like, remember in Planned Parenthood v. Casey, which was one of, you know, the most substantive abortion issues outside of Roe, it was a 5-4 decision, and all five justices that, you know, were in the majority were appointed by Republicans. You know, these were Republicans upholding abortion. And, you know, I suspect that that will happen again, because the courts, you know, even if you put socially conservative justices on the court, to their credit, a lot of them are very uneasy with the court weighing in on these big questions of social order. And, you know, John Roberts, I think, is, I put him in that camp. And, you know, I give him a lot of grief, right? Because I think he was an untested, kind of like a rookie guy we put up without actually really knowing what he believed. So I think there's criticism on that front. But I think he has recognized that the court is now a political, you know, a political function as opposed to this like neutral arbiter. And he's running the court that way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that you're going to continue to see that, because when you've pushed these political questions to the court, a lot of these justices don't want to decide that. And to be honest, I don't really blame them.
Yeah.
Yeah. To pivot the conversation a bit to sort of your other hat, the sort of tech focus, which we've hit a couple of different times here. I'm curious if it's possible that, is there any way to sort of make these debates about tech and the court and social issues less intersectional, to sort of borrow a term from the left? Because something that's sort of funny that's happened the past week is a lot of people who were on the right and the left and were sort of more populist in orientation and were sort of very skeptical of tech and corporate power have been very public at how shocked they are that people on the other side either want to overturn Roe v. Wade or think that abortion, everything's sort of at stake. We're not going to name names here, but we all know what I'm talking about. And I've told multiple people on the right that I don't suspect that any form of left-right consensus against corporate power will come apart, will actually occur, because these social issues will always just sort of intercede. So my question for you is it possible to look at these political issues in separate contexts? Or if they're all together, is it ever possible to sort of de-escalate culture war debates that seem to, for good or for ill, impact everything?
Yeah. No, I see this a lot on the big tech fight. So Internet Accountability Project, you know, the other group that I work with, there are, you know, when we try to cooperate with some groups on the left, they will not work with us, not because of our big tech views, but just because like of who we are.
You're social conservatives.
Yeah. No, literally. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's really disappointing. I think it's really destructive to our politics. You know, there are people that don't think like that, right? They're so cause focused that they realize, like, you know, my enemy can be my friend in this one specific circumstance. If I want to make change badly enough in this area, like, we have to work together. But that sort of intersectionality that you're talking about, where everything is political to the extent that you can't even distinguish one issue from the other, it's like you're all or nothing, is so detrimental. I think, to your point, almost prevents any kind of, you know, right-left populist cooperation on any of these key questions. Now, it's almost also a generational issue. Like, I think some of the, you know, Gen X types that work in this movement are much more comfortable working with Republicans on certain issues. It's the younger sort of woke element in the on the left, at least as I encounter it, that you know, you're either completely with me or you're not with me at all. And how are we supposed to solve any problems if that's how we're approaching things?
Yeah, you're not. And I absolutely see this the same thing through a lot of work we do on Rising and just the amount of shit we take for even, you know, deigning to work together and appearing in the same platform.
It's not even working together. It's literally it's like we said, appearing
next to each other.
There's no pack.
It's a sin, apparently, for a lot. I'll just go out and say, I think this is a left problem. I don't think it's a right problem. I do not see legions of right wingers refusing to work with lefties because they hold certain positions. It almost unilaterally is a left problem of, I'm not going to work with a racist, a fascist, or whatever, because my morals preclude me, even if it would mean the destruction of a cause that I purport to say is existential to the working class of America. Yes, I'm talking about Bernie Sanders and many of the people at the Squad. And I think that's important. I think it does go to show where their true values lie. But I do also think it's fair where the true values lie for a lot of the right, you know, kind of what we're talking about here, which is that a lot of people that I've spoken to are saying that, yes, this could be detrimental to economic issues. This could make it so that, you know, strike down parts of the administrative state, but going in, you know, the end of Roe versus Wade or Casey or whatever is ultimately more important. And I think that's a legitimate point of view to be held. I just do think it validates some of that criticism and shows where some sort of left-right coalition is eventually going to break down. What do you think?
Yeah, you know, I think that's true. I don't see any sort of left-right coalition as long as, like, the Squad has control of the Democrat Party. And I don't say that trying to, it's just my observation. It's just the state of play. I don't mean to ding them. But, and I do think it's really interesting because it is more of a left problem. I think the right, you know, we get dinged all the time, you know, for being, you know, racist or fascist or whatever, but we're actually a pretty ecumenical movement. Like, we have people across the board in the Republican Party, and we're willing to work with Democrats on a number of issues, you know, regardless of how they feel, you know, on an issue that we care about. But I don't get that same sort of cooperation from the left. And I work on a lot of left-leaning issues, sort of on labor, on the economy, on corporate power. And it really limits our effectiveness because they don't want anything to do with me because I tweeted about, you know, that I'm Catholic and pro-life. Yeah. So it's going to limit our effectiveness going forward.
Yeah. And speaking of effectiveness, when we spoke with you back in 2019, it almost feels like 10 years ago, the conversation was solely sort of about tech. And there's obviously a lot of like huge, like sort of tech topics. So for sort of this last section of the conversation, I'd like to sort of just get your lay of the land, right? So you have Section 230 reform up, you've got the TikTok thing, debacle, success. It's not sort of clear what's sort of happening there. So let's start there. Like, how are you feeling about sort of like the TikTok deal and what's going on there?
Man, like it's try to keep up with it. It's like every day there's something new, but you know, just based on where we are today, it looks like the deal is going to fall through. You know, China's calling it like a dastardly deal or whatever they, you know, they're calling it. But I do think that the TikTok issue is a proxy for what's to come in the sense of how we deal with China and these tech issues and the internet. Because I think someone was saying in the Financial Times, I think it was a CSIS scholar who was like, we are engaged in espionage war with China, the greatest, you know, that we've ever seen really since the Cold War. And a lot of that is done through private technology because, well, private in the sense that we consider it private, but it reports to Beijing. Beijing has control over it. You're seeing it with TikTok. You saw it with Huawei, you know, and our posture toward that is TikTok is not the last, you know, element of that. I think we're going to face it in, you know, WeChat, you know, any of these other Chinese apps, you know, that again, China passed a law that says any, you know, tech company operating within its borders, Chinese or not, the government has access to that data. And big data is now the tool of espionage. And so, you know, we, I think as a country are going to be responding to much more than TikTok as it goes ahead. But you still see people, particularly on the right, who are like, no, there's no problem here, right? Like, you know, that these are just private companies the government shouldn't be regulating when there is a clear national security nexus here that I think is only going to grow. China has infiltrated our country with their tech. They just have. And we are going to have to address it case by case, I think, in the days that come. So TikTok is not, I think, is a leading indicator, not a one-off.
So it's fascinating too. We just got done having a discussion about how left and right can never work together. But this actually is one of the one areas where by and large, it mostly worked. I mean, there's a left-wing coalition that agrees that we need to ban TikTok, or at the very least is not going to actively flack for TikTok and for China. There is that element. But it's like this weird horseshoe theory where it's like those people aligned with the libertarians. Yeah, I went and I checked today about who the three people who voted against the Uyghur Forced Labor Act, which would ban products from Xinjiang, all happened to be libertarians. I'm real shocked about that one. And there's this strange alliance between the two, but the broad middle here pretty much agrees that a Chinese-owned corporation, which has access to 100 million Americans' data, is just unacceptable. And I have been thinking a lot about why did it work in this particular case? Like, what is it? Is it just so egregious that we could all agree? Like, nobody really came out against it in a way that, frankly, I was even surprised by. I thought, you know, some establishment senator, somebody like Feinstein or whatever, would come out and go pro TikTok. But I haven't seen a single word. I haven't seen anything from the Biden campaign, Harris. I mean, if TikTok does get banned and it is officially gone from the United States, I see no world where Joe Biden's going to bring it back. I would consider that a victory.
Yeah, I think part of it was that the predicate was laid a little bit. It's not like TikTok, the issue with it came out of the blue, right? Mm-hmm. So the CFIUS had been reviewing the deal since like 2017, and even Chuck Schumer like raised that, you know, wrote a letter that was like, this is concerning, you know, this is China's influence. But I also think you're dealing with kids, and that makes it a lot. It raises, you know, it makes it harder for people to oppose what you're doing, because if the primary users of TikTok are children. And TikTok was fined, I think one of the biggest fines by FTC's history of years ago, you know, for violating the data of children. And, you know, Congress has had hearings on this. you know, Josh Hawley in really dramatic terms, you know, talked about China, Beijing knowing exactly what your child looks like, what their voice sounds like, where they are. And so I think, you know, because kids are involved, I think it raises the stakes a little bit. It's harder for people to come out and oppose it. But again, this isn't, it's not like TikTok came out of the blue. This has been going on for a while. I just wish the same skepticism, I think, was applied, you know, across the board, I think, to more of what we're dealing with in China's tech. I hope it sustains on Huawei, ZTE, you know, all this kind of stuff. Because again, China has no qualms about, you know, using its private enterprise to spy on us. And I think, you know, when big data is the center of all these decisions that we're making, we need to be more skeptical and I think apply more skepticism to these deals.
Yeah. So I'm not normally particularly sympathetic to the arguments about crony capitalism and sort of the government gets involved in the market, everything blows up. But a interesting argument that I've heard from people who were sympathetic to the threat posed by TikTok is that look what happened here. The Trump administration got involved. Instead of just either banning it or doing something straightforward, they rejected the Microsoft deal. And we basically made this weird like Oracle thing where it just happened that, you know, President Trump's like big, one of his biggest donors in Silicon Valley ended up getting this sort of deal. So like what you're really seeing happen there is, and I don't really know obviously know anything about the internal details, but there's like a severe lack of trust clearly on all sort of sides here. So how should we think about that part of the debate? Because I think that is one of the more interesting parts of how this is sort of playing out, potentially going away here.
Yeah. Yeah. Imperfect execution, I think, would be the appropriate term here.
That's a very polite way to put it, Rachel.
Right. But I think this like goes to the need to actually figure out how we're going to address like the mm-hmm. China tech espionage, because this can't be how we do it, right? I think now everybody's, yeah, right, yeah, right? Everybody's sort of scrambling to be like, oh, what do we do? And Trump's like, I like Larry Ellison, you know? It's like, yeah. By the way, I want you to fund my 1776 project, like just toss some money there for facilitating this deal.
Why not,
right?
Rachel?
It's like, yeah. it's like we're shooting from the hip, which, you know, par for the course, right? But yeah. So I think as a matter of national security and a government response, again, if TikTok is a leading indicator, and this is what we're going to see in many different instances, we need to come up with some kind of institutionally appropriate response to how we deal with this. And I think a lot of that is just, you know, shifting the posture of the national security community and even the business community to act with skepticism toward China, because that attitude is not, it doesn't exist everywhere. And so I think we need to change that and then have a sort of government response that you can pull out of the file cabinet to be like, this is how we deal with this, as opposed to whatever this TikTok thing is.
I couldn't agree with you more, Rachel. I mean, it's so frustrating because look, I mean, this is supposed to be, again, a congressional job. They need to set standards for, I mean, look, I have a proposed standard. Majority Chinese ownership of any company in America, banned. That's my standard. I'm probably an extremist whenever it comes to that, but
yeah,
I'm willing to negotiate.
Some would call that position insane.
I mean, it's, by the way, that's the position of the Chinese in their own country. So I believe very much in reciprocal trade deals and reciprocal treatment here at home. But
fair,
you know,
trade.
But
fair
again,
trade.
I'm willing to negotiate on that. But again, this cannot be some sort of ad hoc kicking it to Larry. Now it's falling apart. Wilbur Ross can't even keep his eyes open. And I'm supposed to trust this guy to review a deal with this matter of like this this amount of importance to our markets. I just think it's absolutely ridiculous. And that is, Marshall, I will grant your friends, your libertarian friends, that that chit whenever it comes to what happened whenever people did get involved here. I think overall, though, this isn't the only tech question, right, Rachel, which is that we have bigger questions about elements of power that don't involve China. And I think that's where it gets way, way stickier. Just tell us about kind of how your updated thinking, kind of since the last time that we talked, just about the power of the tech companies in particular, and whether any of the things that you warned about ended up coming to pass.
Well, I think, you know, between last year me and this year me, I'm like more scared, I think.
You're like, actually, everything's good. You're like, it's fine. We closed up shop, you know.
Like the black pill looms ever larger in my future on this question. Because, you know, I do think like the power of these tech companies is existential in the sense that like they have the power to filter information for huge amounts of the world. And I'm primarily talking about Google here, you know, who has 90% of the market on search. You know, people think they're getting unbiased search results. They're not. You know, but even Facebook, where you have over half of Americans getting their news from Facebook, you know, and Facebook making all kinds of decisions about what's appropriate news and what's not. I think that those, the effects of that have been put on blast by two things. One, COVID-19, and two, the election. I think you're really starting to see the power of that these companies exert over independent thinking in a free society. I think with COVID-19, you know, you're literally seeing YouTube, which is owned by Google, make medical choices about what is good medical science and what is bad medical science. Mm. You know, they recently took down a video of Scott Atlas, who is a, you know, neuroradiologist professor at Stanford Medical School, affiliated with the Hoover Institute, having a very empirically data-driven discussion about do lockdowns, you know, costs and benefits of lockdowns. YouTube took it down because it was anti-science, right? They're making these decisions. You know, the really infamous example is when they took down the video of the medically, you know, board certified physicians talking about hydroxychloroquine, right? That had to be banned on every single platform, you know, not just YouTube. It was Facebook, it was Twitter, it was Vimeo. It was like down the road or down the line. And so, you know, a lot of people have pointed this out, but, you know, these are not quack, like these are not eat a Tide Pod, you know, videos. they're actual, you know, medical, you know, doctors talking about things that are up for debate, talking about things that people will talk about with their own doctors, yes, you know, and make decisions that are best for them. And, you know, so that I think is a really concerning development that you're seeing, especially, and again, all of this is linked to the dominance of these platforms, right? If YouTube filtered information for 20% of the world, I would feel far different. But because of their massive user base, this is primarily where people focus. So there's downstream effects on independent behavior, on independent thought. And you're seeing this with the election, I think, to some extent as well. It was recently reported in Axios that the government, the federal government was meeting with Twitter and Facebook and Google to war game, you know, certain electoral scenarios. And that to me is just chilling. If these companies, these private unaccountable corporations have so much power over the integrity of our elections, that the government has to meet with them and ask, like we're in some kind of negotiation with another country and to compel their certain behaviors from them, that should give us pause, you know?
Yeah. And the thing is you're getting at why the right has a hard time, I think, thinking logically about this issue. Because what I appreciate about the way you framed this was you weren't just sort of just focused on bias per se, because there's like a deep, and this is the sort of recurring thing that we've talked about here, is the idea of power and what is power and how is it sort of exercised. And the point that you're making is that in many ways, like Facebook is a government unto itself with, you know, 1.3 billion citizens. And in many respects, like there is sort of these speech ideas. There's the idea that because we don't really understand network effects, we have a hard time of basically the idea that because everyone sort of, you know, once you get a bunch of people on Facebook, it's hard to get them to sort of leave. That really sort of matters here. But I think the right's discussion of this topic is usually just so pointless because it seems to be, basically we see the situation, and I want to know how you think we get out of the following situation, which is basically you bring in the tech CEOs, some backbench congressman says, oh, Zuck, like, why are you so biased? You know, and look, I think that's largely a structural thing. Like, it just as like there are professions that are more conservative, there are probably more conservative cops than there are liberal cops. And there are probably more liberal journalists than there are conservative journalists. There's no conspiracy. There's just certain realities there. I don't think anyone's proposing like, you know, affirmative action for conservative social media moderators. So like, how do we move on to the broader discussion of the real complaint you have, Congressman, is that Facebook has all this power over your speech. You don't actually care that 7 out of 10 of them went to liberal arts school. So how do we move past that?
Yeah, that's what frustrates me about the bias argument too, because it lends itself to this critique that, oh, we just want to regulate tech companies to enforce our version of, you know, whatever the view should be, which I just think, I'm sure there are some people that want to do that, but it's incorrect in my view, because you know, at the central question is what you just raised, which is corporate power on such a scale that it starts to have impacts downstream on a free society, on a democratic society, and how we behave. But I think for the right, it's a very difficult critique to make because the right is just dispositionally not yet set up to critique corporate power.
Yes.
And that's, people have people on the right have a really hard time with my argument in that regard. And I get called a statist and I get called all these things. But in reality, that's the issue and they are unprepared to address it.
That's what I wanted to end with. Oh, go ahead. Go ahead.
And I've got another
Marshall,
one.
Marshall, I know that you talked recently to FCC Commissioner Brendan Carr, I think. Yeah. And he has started to make some of these arguments too, that conservatism must have or should have a response to corporate power. You know, that is, and conservatism is equipped for this. And I've written a lot about this. You know, we are prepared to answer these questions. We just have this sort of like, our philosophical underpinnings have ossified into this weird ideological reflexiveness that says everything a corporation does is good, full stop. And I think shedding that is a lot of the work that I do, trying to anyway.
And actually what's cool here, Rachel, is, and I'm searching for something because I want to make sure I get it. We do this new thing on the show called realignment questions, where we let our listeners ask questions. And you actually just got to a question this week. So if you wouldn't mind, I'd love to get your answer to this. So this is from Mike Petrovic. And he says, to your point about corporate power, he says, who do you think the fundraising base for the average House member who's running on this sort of platform would be, which is corporate, right-leaning skepticism? Where would it sort of be? Because he doesn't really see the Wall Street or upper middle class corporate types funding anything you're sort of talking about. So I didn't have an answer to this question, so I'm hoping that you have something on this, because how does this sort of work from a campaign finance and a sort of donor energy perspective?
Yeah, this is a question I think a lot of us are grappling with on the right, because, you know, there's been a lot of research actually that shows that the Republican donor base is further to the right on economic issues, on corporate power issues, than actual Republican voters.
Yeah.
Right. And so they fund this sort of very like corporate power is good emphasis. And it's really hard to get away from that. So where is the other donor base? And I think, you know, more broadly, it's going to have to be away from these sort of ideological donor groups and more to specific individual donors, but also specific industries. We don't have this as much on the right, but like, you know, the steel industry, I think, could be very self-interested in, you know, having a different kind of response to free markets and free trade, you know, than a sort of trade association or corporate entity might. And so I think if you start to see that the individual industries break out of this, you know, sending their money to their trade association, which sends it to, you know, whatever congressman, and start to actually get involved in this game individually, that I think will break up the flow a little bit. But I think to your point, it's a very difficult question, because behavior is incentivized by the money in this town, and all the money in this town is toward corporations.
Yeah. Let me just, I want to answer that too, because I love that question, which is, look, it's just harder. That's the truth. These people don't want to work that hard. So easy to go to a couple fundraisers, a certain conference in Wichita and Jackson Hole, and raise a lot of money, and you're good to go. You know what's harder? Actually organizing. And this is something that people on the left are actually a lot better at, which is that they organize and then they raise funds through small dollar donations in a much better way than a lot of the people on the right. And look, the pool of money is there. Right now, Trump is winning more than half of people in trades, in the trades unions, despite the fact that the trade union leadership is all in for Joe Biden. There's actually a political story that just came out about how union leadership is like, we can't convince our guys not to vote for Trump. They're like, we literally don't know what to do. So again, like, the members are willing to give you the money. They're even willing, I bet you they might vote if you invested any infrastructure whatsoever into trying to, you know, get interested in union leadership, union politics. That's just unions. And like you said, industries or just people. There are a lot of people out there. To the extent that there's a small dollar donor operation on the right, it's all cultural focus. It's not economic. And I think that we actually need to rebalance what those two things are. And Rachel, this is the last thing I really wanted to get with you, which is you used to work, you're a libertarian. So, I mean, you were a libertarian. You entered professional politics that way. What happened to you? Did you get mugged by reality? Like, what's going on here? Because I think this is an important question for people who are out there who are skeptical of the things that I say, less skeptical of the things Marshall says, and are like...
Thanks, Sagar.
they're skeptical. They're like, I don't know. This guy just sounds like a leftist. I mean, make the case here. How can you still be conservative and believe in the things you do?
So... this is so interesting. I think it's why the DC libertarian movement hates me so much, because they think I'm a heretic. But but I'm really not, right? So to get to your question, like, yeah, my when I worked on Capitol Hill, you know, I was the legislative director for Senator Rand Paul. And I also worked for Pat Toomey and Mike Lee, probably the three most libertarian leaning Republican senators. Yeah.
Smart, very smart, serious people.
Seriously,
right? Like, not, they're not trolls. Like, they're serious, mm-hmm. like libertarian senators.
Yeah. So, well, I think I came at it from a little bit of a different perspective because my first job on Capitol Hill was actually in the House. And I was working on the House Financial Services Committee for a very senior member, staffing him through TARP. Okay. And I saw firsthand, I was 24 years old, and I saw firsthand the meltdown that occurred. I sat in the briefings with Ben Bernanke and, you know, Hank Paulson, and it was my first inkling that corporate power might not be the greatest thing ever. You know, as I watched the government bail out the banks and I watched my grandparents lose everything at the same time. Like, the priorities of the government were very clear. And, you know, I consider myself more of a sort of, I know we use this term sometimes, a folk libertarian, right? Because I think there's a sort of entrenched movement in DC that are, they're not actually libertarians, they're corporatists. And by that, I mean, they just blindly defend private business and call it libertarianism. But I don't think that's what libertarianism truly is. And I worked for the members I did because I'm inherently skeptical of concentrations of power wherever they are, whether they're in corporations, whether they're in the government. And the work that I did in particular for Rand Paul and Mike Lee was about about government surveillance. And so I was very involved in the USA Freedom Act, which ended bulk metadata collection on Americans. And it's something I still believe in, but I apply that skepticism not just to the government. I also apply it to corporations in the case of big tech that are actually bigger than the government, bigger than many small governments. And I think you arguably more powerful over individual liberty. And so the difference between me and I think a lot of the people who call themselves libertarians in DC is that I see corporations being a threat to individual liberty as well as the government. And I don't think those questions are mutually exclusive. And so that's how I still call myself more of like a folk libertarian in that sense. And it drives people crazy. So
it's a great term, actually. I encourage people to more adopt that because I try to highlight this for people on my show, the difference between folk libertarianism and DC libertarianism. There's a huge difference between, you know, a more culturally libertarian person or even somebody who's just skeptical of power in any form, and then somebody who's basically, like you said, paid to go out and say any regulation whatsoever against business, that's not libertarian. I thought we were Republicans. And the difference between those two things, I mean, frankly, the vast majority of self-identifying libertarians in this country would agree with you and not with most of their paid operatives in DC. And that's just another case for, I think, what the realignment here talks a lot about, which is representative power versus what people actually believe.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And this, and it used to be, you know, the Republican Party had a lot of libertarians in it who were completely okay with the skepticism of private business. Mm-hmm. Reason Magazine, I think, had a quote that was like, "We are skeptical," from Barry Goldwater, actually. And they called him the first libertarian politician. Reason Magazine, okay? And they had a quote from him that said, you know, concentrations of power are bad wherever they are. We will seek them out, you know, and destroy them, basically. That used to be a controlling feature of the Republican Party. We lost that skepticism of mega corporate power to our detriment, in my view.
No, and I think that's a pessimistic but very poignant point to end the podcast on. Rachel, thank you so much for coming.
Thanks, Rachel. It was a really great conversation.
Thanks, guys.
Hope you guys enjoyed the episode. Be sure to email us a question at realignmentpod@gmail.com or scroll to the bottom of your podcast app. Be sure to leave us a 5-star rating and leave us a question with your rating as well, too, if you want to get an answer on air.
That's right. And as always, a special thank you to the Lincoln Network for sponsoring our work and hosting our work here at The Realignment. We can't thank them enough. And with that, we will see you guys next week.